So I'm Roger Melko, and this is, I hope, condensed matter theory. So just a note today, we all have to observe a 1 minute of silence at 11 o'clock. You know, today's Remembrance Day in all Commonwealth countries, which is, you know, Remembrance Day started after World War I, which is why we wear the poppy here. And so it's standard to basically take one or two moments of silence, minutes of silence. So we'll observe a minute at 11 o'clock, so we won't get into any real serious calculations before then, hopefully. So, what class did you guys just have before this? CFT? QFTO. Okay, so you're taking quantum field theory now, so that's great. So what we're going to be learning is condensed matter. And for which of you is this the first condensed matter class that you've taken? So many of you, okay. So, you know, what do you think condensed matter is? Maybe just yell something out. What's your impressions of condensed matter? Say it louder, nobody heard you. It's good, keep it in mind. What else? Say it again.
Large numbers of things in a small amount of space.
I like that answer, yeah. Doesn't necessarily have to be a small area of space, maybe, but it's a large number of things, right? Anything else? So, you know, condensed matter historically was driven a lot by materials research. And so the connotations you have of condensed matter are probably based in materials research. Solid state physics was the old name for it. And solid state physics was sort of literally the study of these solid state systems, basically solid systems and the electrons, the electronic potentials inside of those systems and so on. And condensed matter has evolved from that time. I mean, even the name of the theory or the field has evolved from solid state into condensed matter. So yes, it's a study of materials. And by materials, I mean, you know, real materials that you can touch, but also more and more matter systems. So I might say matter. Which are maybe less conventional, maybe atoms trapped in an optical lattice or some sort of more exotic matter like that. And as mentioned, it's also the study of very many things. And not very many things in the sense that, you know, we just group a whole bunch of non-interacting particles together and we solve a one particle problem. It's a study of really complex systems, right? And that's a very good sort of unifying sort of paradigm. I'll talk more about complexity in a minute. So, because it's very fundamental in terms of the study of many particle systems, condensed matter is actually branching out quite a bit from its roots. You know, branching out from just studying, say, semiconductors, superconductors, stuff that you might sort of associate with condensed matter. So you'll notice that modern condensed matter theorists study also, you know, they study these things. They study sort of conventional materials, but they also study many things like I mentioned up here, say, cold atomic systems. More and more condensed matter and quantum condensed matter practitioners are studying artificial systems, so complex artificial systems. So you might say something like, one example would be quantum systems. So Ray LaFlamme might kill me if I ask you, but who's heard of the D-Wave device? The D-Wave device is this adiabatic quantum computing machine that's been built in Vancouver. And condensed matter theorists have been studying the D-Wave device. Why? Because the D-Wave device is like a black box. Nobody quite knows what's going on inside of the thing, right? And if you went to the IQC colloquium last week, Matthias Troyer who is a condensed matter theorist, basically talked about the theory behind what's going on in this device, and it's really treated as an experiment. You know, they put in some input into the D-Wave device, they do some theory and some simulations, and they try to model what's going on inside of this thing with all the conventional tools of condensed matter theory or condensed matter physics. And so, you know, one idea here is that human beings are now making artificial systems that are so complex that the tools of condensed matter are the tools that we need to study these things. And the D-Wave device is just one example of that. You'll also see many condensed matter physicists working in sort of complex data networks. So for example, humans are generating networks of such high complexity through, say, Facebook and Twitter and these types of social networks, also the internet, also, you know, financial markets and stuff like that, that ab initio, if you will, or first principle study of these networks is typically impossible. And so you'll see many condensed matter theorists and physicists transition into careers, you know, either in finance or data science or something like that, because the tools that we learn in condensed matter, you know, not only the fundamental tools like quantum field theory and stuff like that, but statistical mechanical treatment of complex systems come into play when we study these data networks. So it's also cross-disciplinary with many other fields of physics. So you're learning quantum field theory, and you know there's a lot of practitioners in condensed matter theory that use quantum field theory. Quantum field theory was adapted by condensed matter theorists essentially in the 70s. There was sort of a great, I think they call it like a unification of theory or something like that. And the context of this sort of incorporation was the renormalization group. So if you've taken Anton Berkov's class, right, and you've done some RG with him. Okay, so the sort of 5-4 theories, the renormalization group techniques you learn in that class, were brought to condensed matter in the 70s by, you know, actually people associated with Perimeter. So Kadanoff, who teaches psi once in a while. So Ken Wilson, who's very famous and who died recently. He was the advisor of Steve White, who's a distinguished visiting research chair. And let's see, who else? Michael Fisher, who was the father of another visiting research chair, Matthew Fisher. So there's, you know, very little degrees of separation between the Perimeter Institute and the people who brought field theory into the condensed matter sphere. So at the time, they called this a grand synthesis. It's not the grand unification that you guys are looking for, but it really brought the theoretical foundation of condensed matter on par with quantum physics and other things. So now the field theory that's being used in condensed matter is quite sophisticated. I mean, conformal field theories are used quite often, topological field theories, so all these things that you guys will learn in other classes. What else do I want to say? Oh, one thing that is kind of interesting in terms of this cross-disciplinary nature. So has anyone heard of the Higgs boson? That was a joke. So have you heard of the Anderson-Higgs mechanism? Does anyone know who Anderson is? Philip Anderson's a professor in Princeton. And, you know, the mechanism behind essentially the Higgs boson was really, I wouldn't say discovered necessarily. I think the particle itself wasn't postulated until later, but was first discussed by Anderson essentially a year before these famous papers came out by Higgs and others. And Anderson was studying superconductivity. He was studying on the problem of Goldstone modes and gauge symmetry, essentially in the BCS theory. And I think the Higgs mechanism is discussed in this context in his 1963 paper. So it's you know a year or so before a lot of this was discussed in the high energy theories by you know Kibble and Higgs and all these guys. So condensed matter has had this sort of strong synergy for a long time with if you want to call it more sort of fundamental physics. But one of the main differences that really stands out for condensed matter is the presence of experimental systems. So condensed matter is very largely an experimentally driven field. And so you'll notice condensed matter theorists working on materials like graphene, which were experimentally sort of isolated recently, even stuff like these complex artificial quantum systems, they're studied by condensed matter theorists, you know, less before they're created and more after they're created. So I would argue that condensed matter stays grounded in some sense by being an experimentally driven field. So what's the main problem that we're trying to solve in condensed matter physics? We know fundamentally how electrons behave in materials and matter and complex systems and you know artificial systems and so on. So what is the central mystery, you know? So for example, we know from undergraduate quantum mechanics the basic, the basic Hamiltonian of some interacting quantum system. And it's just a Hamiltonian of particles labeled by I that are electrons, ions, you know, whatever those species are. They could be living in a crystal, they could be living in a fluid, a gaseous phase, whatever. So, and you know, remember when you solve the time-independent Schrodinger equation for, you know, the hydrogen atom, say, and you can basically solve this problem exactly, this time-independent Schrodinger equation. Then as you start to make the system more complex, so maybe you add, maybe it's helium, so your nucleus is somehow two protons, and the system gets more complex, and the electron-electron interaction is really what kills you, right? And so at some point, you start looking at variational techniques, perturbation theory, and all this type of stuff. So the central sort of problem with condensed matter is that how can we take this simple quantum mechanical Hamiltonian describing electrons and how do we solve this in such a way that we can explain sort of macroscopic or complex or quantum many-body phenomena? Okay, it's 11. Let's take a moment of silence and we'll get back. I'll write this provocative statement. This quantum antibody Hamiltonian is infinitely complex. You're used to studying infinities here at Perimeter. You study the infinitely small, you study string theory itself. You study cosmology, right? The large-scale structure of galaxies and of the universe and everything. So these length scales have meaning, right? What does it mean to be infinitely complex? Is it just an excuse for why we can't solve anything? Well, really, as you know, any of you who study sort of quantum information know, we could say we threw away all like sorts of degrees of freedom from this electronic Hamiltonian. And let me just take the spin degrees of freedom of the electron, like you said. Then those spin degrees of freedom, we can even demonstrate that just these spin degrees of freedom are, they're not only infinitely complex in the sense that we can't solve the Schrodinger equation, we can't even store, the Hilbert space, if you will, of any typical macroscopic system. So, we won't even consider itinerant particles. We're just looking at the spin up eigenstate SZ 1/2 and minus 1/2, the two-state system. And the Hilbert space is 2 because of the two states of the spin to the n, where n is the number of particles. And if you start to look at the size of this Hilbert space, say, if I had a 4x4 lattice of qubits, if you want to call them something like that, we're talking about 65,000, whatever. I forget the rest of it. 65 something, approximately. That's no problem. Your computer can handle this, no problem, right? So what if I want to do a 16x16 lattice? I want to store the Hilbert space. That number is, I wrote this one down, it's about 10 to the 77. That doesn't mean, that's not solving the system. That's taking the Hilbert space and trying to take, one bit, which represents maybe everything spin up. One bit, you flip a bit, it's one spin down. So just from an information perspective, just storing the Hilbert space requires 10 to the 77, essentially bits. But that number is, I'm no cosmologist, but this is comparable to the number of particles in the universe. So I can't remember if this accounts for dark matter and everything. It's between 10 to the 77 and 10 to the 80. So this isn't even a matter of our computers aren't sophisticated enough. This is a fundamental issue. And that's only the spin states of the electron. What if I go back and talk about position eigenstates or momentum eigenstates or something like that? You can see essentially that once you get past a few hundred, a few tens of particles in the system, it becomes completely intractable. And in fact, if you're talking about things that like electrons on a lattice hopping with some potential and so on, the state of the art of solving that problem, like actually diagonalizing that problem, is something between say 10 and 20 electrons, and that's with massive machines. Like that's with these huge computers we have in SharkNet and in the basement of the physics building and stuff like that. This problem here, just solving for the ground state wave function, so just doing some sort of iterative diagonalization. So I can exactly diagonalize a 16-site system, no problem. But once I get to about 35 to 40 sites, that spin problem can't even project out the ground state. So I think the record, if you put in a whole bunch of symmetries in the Hilbert space, it's something like 42 to 48 qubits. call them qubits. So you can see that this is an entirely unsolved problem. I mean, many people here work on this type of complex quantum many-body system. So how can we ever hope to attack anything like this Hamiltonian? You know, how can we ever write some theory down that starts from the Schrodinger equation, which as you know, is just an approximation from some more complicated field theory, if you will, right? So how can we even pretend that we're going to, you know, if we solve some, you know, if we understand sort of microscopic physics, if we have some grand unified theory, how are we ever going to describe materials and matter, the universe as we see it at these length scales? And so the answer maybe is that we'll never be able to. But what we can do is make series of approximations, and we can sort of construct a framework of understanding that's based on not only the microscopics, but also basically other properties that emerge in the system. And so this is sort of the idea of emergence. Reductionism is just what it sounds like. Reducing the size of things, reducing the complexity of things down to its essential constituents. This is the history of physics. You know, we discovered atoms and then split the atom and electrons and the nucleus and split that up into protons and neutrons. Then we understand quarks. We understand the, you know, the makeup of quarks, the interaction between quarks. So we understand the four fundamental forces, the gauge symmetries that go into all these things. That's reductionalist. Okay? Reducing things down and down to some very sort of fundamental objects. And so in some sense, string theory and other, you know, quantum gravity theories is like the natural sort of endpoint of this reductionalist paradigm. Emergent is sort of just what I'm saying here. Emergence is the idea that no matter how far we reduce down, we'll never be able to sort of reconstruct the behavior of matter at larger length scales or intermediate energies because of this infinite complexity that gets in the way. So just another mention of Anderson. Anderson said it well, the ability to reduce everything to simple fundamental laws does not imply the ability to start from those laws and reconstruct the universe. Because you get into a problem essentially with the complexity of everything. So what do we do? We have emergent phenomena now that I'm discouraging you from studying, like superconductivity, or you know Goldstone modes in a ferromagnet, or topological order, right? Topological insulators, any of these exotic phases of matter and excitations that we deal with all the time. So essentially, we're constructing, if you will, like a framework for the theory based on, you know, not only the microscopics, but also the phenomenon that we observe. And condensed matter theory is a unification of sort of fundamental field theory and an explanation of more emergent, an emergent viewpoint. Okay. So let's start by defining some basic concepts. So you already know some concepts that'll serve as our foundation: statistical mechanics, thermodynamics, quantum field theory. So let's put those into a perspective or into a framework by which we can attack, all the interesting phenomenon that we hope to discuss in the context of that that Schrodinger equation. And through a lifetime of trial and error in studying condensed matter systems, I'd say these three sort of paradigmatic ideas give us the foundation for the theory that we're constructing. So broken symmetries, okay, and the broken symmetry is, which I'll explain in a minute, is something that sort of identifies, if you will, a ground state. The excitations out of that ground state, okay, so they're somehow violations of the broken symmetry, and then other types of defects that are slightly more complicated, topological defects, which seem like a detail, but turn out to underlie much of the important quantum, macroscopic quantum phenomena that we observe in condensed matter. So broken symmetry, so the absence, this is like some people call this a Landau paradigm. But of course, like the Higgs mechanism, there's many other people behind this, but we just choose one name for it. So if I had to choose, we might choose Landau as being the father of a lot of these ideas. And the sort of lowest level concept is that the presence or absence of a certain symmetry in a phase of matter is almost never ambiguous. It identifies the phase of a system. It doesn't have to be matter. It could be the universe itself. So as you might know, the universe went through phase transitions in its early history, and these are transitions between different broken symmetry states. I'm going to say almost here. The presence or absence of a certain symmetry element is almost never ambiguous, I should say, in a certain state of matter. And I say almost because there are violations of this Landau paradigm. And a lot of this recent excitement in condensed matter physics that has to do with topological phases is precisely because symmetry elements aren't giving you all the, I guess they're not identifying the underlying characteristics of that phase. So what does this mean? So low symmetry phases and high symmetry phases differ fundamentally. High symmetry phases signify disorder. So for example, at high temperature. Whereas low symmetry phases, so if a high symmetry is broken down to a low symmetry, They signify ordered phases. And the concept of order is the concept of symmetry in this context. So low symmetry phases identify order, and they're separated from the high symmetry phase by a phase transition. So you've already seen this in Anton Berkov's class, where he discussed the separation of a high symmetry phase from a low symmetry phase in a magnetic system, right? And in a low symmetry phase in that magnetic system that you guys studied is signaled by the appearance of an order parameter. So you even developed a theory for this. So I hope you guys looked at this. Do you remember looking at the Ising model? Yes? That was H equals minus J sum over IJ. And I'll just talk about the SZ components of the spins. So you might imagine this is a model of only the degrees of freedom of the electronic spins, and maybe only the classical limit of that case. So it's a very highly complexity reduced system. But as you learned, there is a lot of complexity still left in the system. So do you remember what the high temperature phase is? The high symmetry phase? Yep. And low symmetry was called. So what is the broken symmetry there? Not the group. What's the symmetry that's broken? What's the name of the symmetry that's broken? Yeah, you heard time reversal symmetry? Yeah, so. Yeah, so several names for it. So you might call it time reversal symmetry or Ising up-down symmetry or something like that. It's a Z2 discrete group, right? So you have a high temperature phase and you measure the magnetization. That's the order parameter associated with that broken symmetry, right? And it goes to, say, unity if it's normalized property. And in this phase, below some transition temperature, which in two dimensions, so right, this is d greater than 2, greater than or equal to 2. In two dimensions, there's an exact solution for this. And in three dimensions and higher, there's not. One of the great unsolved mysteries of stat mech, right? So this is a broken symmetry phase, so broken, say, time reversal, some Z2 symmetry. And this concept of tying an order parameter, so what the magnetization is in this system is just a measure of this Z2, because there's a spontaneously broken symmetry where the system can be all up or all down. And that's broken down from the high symmetry state, so this is the paramagnetic state, where the state has the same symmetry as a Hamiltonian. And so this example of broken symmetries is sort of prevalent not only in these statistical mechanical systems, but also in condensed matter systems. So all conventional phases of matter can be identified by whatever broken symmetry occurs in that state. And I'll say, by conventional, I mean like Landau obeying, which is by definition true for a conventional phase of matter. But there's ones that, there are phases of matter that cannot be identified by a broken symmetry, but we won't talk about those in this first week. Oops, identified. Okay, so the one we saw here was, so let me make a table. So let me call it a phase. Broken symmetry. Excitations out of that thing. Okay, so there's an order parameter. Order parameter excitations and, well, we won't talk about these, but the topological defects. So we just discussed the ferromagnetic phase. As a broken time reversal symmetry, a Z2 symmetry. It's time reversal because, well, if you switch T for minus T, right, in the Schrodinger equation, it's the angular momentum value that changes from, like, say, LZ equals up to, or SZ equals up to SZ equals down. But also if you have like a, if you do an effective classical, so say you had a current loop and the current was going in a certain direction, you get a moment associated with that current loop. That's like a magnetic moment. You reverse the direction of that current loop, so you run it backwards in time. You flip the direction of that moment. So that's the sort of source of that time reversal symmetry. The order parameter is magnetization. The elementary excitations in a ferromagnet are something we will study this week, called spin waves or magnons. And I should emphasize, you know, not only is the broken symmetry in the order parameter, you know, an identifying feature of a phase, you know, these excitations and also the topological defects. So in this case, it would be some domain wall, which I probably won't talk about. The excitations and the defects are also important in characterizing that phase. So why is this? So you can imagine the vacuum state of a system as being this broken symmetry. So when you're studying our vacuum, our natural vacuum, we're in some low energy state. There's certain symmetries obeyed by that state. There's also excitations out of that vacuum. Okay, so for us, the excitations are particles, conventional particles. It can be an electron or something like that, right? In condensed matter, it's the same idea. We can have a broken state at, say, zero temperature, a broken symmetry state. That could be some sort of magnetic system. And that symmetry can be quite complex, especially if it's on a lattice. It can all have all these point group symmetries associated with the lattice. Excitations out of that are the fundamental particles of that universe, if you want. So, for example, it's known experimentally that there are certain magnetic systems on a lattice that break certain symmetries such that their excitations are monopoles. So they're fundamental monopoles. I'm not saying there's monopoles existing in a crystal that somehow come in from, you know, cosmological rays or something like that. It's the collective excitation, the low energy excitation that occurs in the crystal. So it might be lattice vibrations, or it might be, you know, waves of in the long sort of long wavelength waves and the spins or something like that, have exactly the same fundamental quantum operator, if you will, of a monopole. And so in some sense, monopoles do exist, but they exist in tabletop experiments in condensed matter systems. And these are studied quite a bit over it in these so-called spin ice systems at University of Waterloo. There's other more complicated systems that also have emergent, if you will, excitations that are very fundamentally different than what we find in the sort of natural vacuum. So we can have all sorts of non-abelian, anionic, you know, species and so on. So if you're the type of like theorist that wants to study stuff that doesn't exist in nature, well, quite often it does exist in nature, but in some complex sort of condensed matter system. And the modern study of condensed matter is, in some sense, the study of these very fundamental excitations, which arise in these strange vacuum states. Okay, this, the ferromagnet maybe not such a strange state, but other states are.
I have a question. When you talk about this excitations of the vacuum, like for example in quantum field theory, we have a unique vacuum. Here in condensed matter systems, there is the possibility of having a degenerate Brown state.
Right.
Right. So are those excitations well defined? If they depend on the Brown state to which I'm looking.
Some states don't have well defined excitations in them. So a pneumatic, like a liquid crystal, might be an example of that. So there are, you know, there are condensed matter systems where this paradigm isn't fully sort of realized in some emergent way. Conversely, yeah, so I mean, you can have systems that have many degenerate ground states, but that can be sort of a feature. So, you know, like gauge theories on a lattice, like a Z2 gauge theory, I don't know if you guys study this stuff, it has a whole bunch of degeneracies in the ground state. Okay, that ground state wave function is something topologically non-trivial. They call it a loop gas sometimes. Okay, so it's like a bunch of non-interacting strings. I mean, these can be realized in actual systems. So now the excitations of those strings are very fundamentally interesting. They can be bosonic, electronic. They can be non-abelian, braiding statistics. So even though the ground state is highly degenerate, you know, it's the sort of the emergent theory can be sort of quite elegant. It can be described by all sorts of field theories and so on. So this is what Xiaogun Wen, who's your advisor or your lecturer next week, is an expert in. I mean, he really defined this field in a lot of ways. It's topological phases, you know, these very strange vacuums that occur in topological systems. And the excitations in those topological systems, they're particles, they're fundamental particles, you know, unlike anything we see in a natural vacuum. So magnons, we'll talk about, are kind of a plain vanilla boson. I'm not, the domain walls in this case won't be that important. I mentioned pneumatics. So a pneumatic phase is a liquid crystal, a state of a liquid crystal, where you might have these sort of like oblong shaped, whatever they are, molecules or species. And in a pneumatic phase, they line up in some way. So this might be the low symmetry state, or yeah, the broken symmetry state, which breaks some sort of rotational symmetry. So liquid crystals, you know, liquid crystal displays, these things we use every day, they rely on some sort of broken rotational symmetry. And you can have some sort of, I don't know, vector operator that has an expectation value, like, you know, this might point along the z direction. Doesn't matter. These things don't have fundamental low-lying excitations that are interesting in any sense. But they do have topological defects. I think these are disclinations. So just because you can invent some sort of interesting condensed matter vacuum, if you will, a broken symmetry state, it doesn't mean that it has an interesting spectrum associated with the excitations.
What are disclinations?
So disclinations are So if you imagine all these molecules lined up, they're sort of long wavelength rotations. So my order parameter might be in the z direction here, but at some point there's some topological defect that makes it in the x direction. So this is different than dislocations which occur in a crystal. What we're going to talk about today is crystals. Crystals have broken symmetry states there. You take all your atoms, some alkali metal, whatever, you cool it down, it forms a crystal, right? What's the symmetry broken? It's translation symmetry there. So, you know, the R, I don't know how to write it. R going to R plus some arbitrary translation vector, that symmetry is broken. Galilean invariance is broken in that sense. So the order parameter are, in this case, is just some density. The density of atoms that occurs at some point is higher than some other. What we're going to talk about tomorrow is the elementary excitations out of a crystal lattice, which are phonons. And in a quantum mechanical sense, these are sort of elementary bosons. So here we're going to have a vacuum state, that's a crystal, that I can grow in a laboratory. And I'm going to have, it has a broken symmetry, I'm going to find elementary excitations out of that vacuum that are conventional bosons, if you will. These have topological defects, dislocations. And dislocations in a crystal plane are like, so one dislocation in a crystal plane looks something like this. So you have all these nice crystal planes, and you can have one dislocation in the plane. So this idea of topological defects comes really important when we study superfluids. Which are very closely related to superconducting phases. So a Bose-Einstein condensate superfluid, a superconducting phase. Does anyone know the broken symmetry in the ground state of that system? So this is gauge invariance is broken. A means the phase of the wave function, the quantum mechanical wave function, spontaneously picks a direction. Okay, so here your magnetic moment spontaneously picks a direction, like Anton taught you, right? You have spontaneous symmetry breaking in the ground state of a magnet that gives you this broken time reversal symmetry. In a superfluid, you have broken gauge invariance. Which is like, you know, the wave function, you know, gauge invariance is invariance under adding an arbitrary phase. So we'll talk about this. I'll show you why in some simple model you get a broken gauge invariance. The order parameter in that case is the expectation value of the wave function itself. I'll talk about this. It's something to do with the number of particles that occur in the ground state of the system and the phase of that wave function. The elementary excitations, okay, so these can be bosonic or fermionic. In a superfluid, they're bosonic. They're phonons and rotons, which maybe we'll talk about. They're electrons in a superconductor. And the topological defect in these quantum phases are vortices. Okay, so they're basically, so if I map the phase of that wave function out, I can basically get a point where I have a topological defect. I'll do a long wavelength picture. The phase of that wave function is ordered everywhere. I'm just drawing it like a spin. But that's thinking of a long wavelength sort of topological defect. I don't know if you can see that. I didn't draw very well. I'll do a better job next time. There's a broken rotational symmetry in the phase of that wave function. You can have a single vortex which pierces that thing and causes the broken symmetry state to have this defect in it. And that's just a survey of some common phases of matter. Okay. So again, there's other symmetries that quantum systems have. You can have symmetry under, symmetry or anti-symmetry under particle exchange. That distinguishes between bosons and fermions. But no, we won't talk about that here.
Sorry. There, do you just mean U1 gauge invariance?
Yeah. Or yeah, it's U1 gauge invariance there. So in week two, well, we're not quite sure what Shagun's going to talk about, but he may talk about some topological defects if he gets to it, and other important topological considerations. In week three, Anush will be teaching superconductivity. So you'll be learning a lot about this concept of broken U1 gauge invariance and the quasi-particle excitations that occur in superconductors and so on. So today what we're going to look at is, since you did ferromagnets already with Anton, we're going to look at crystals. We're not going to talk about pneumatics. So we're going to talk about crystals. We're going to talk about translations in crystals. We'll talk about the elementary excitations tomorrow, which are the phonons, and show how they're, an example of an emergent particle in this system. Okay, and I mean emergence in the same sense that I wrote emergence here. We don't have an ab initio microscopic theory, okay, but we have a theory that starts from the broken symmetry state and gives us a description of not only that state, but the elementary excitations out of that state. And we can look at those excitations, mathematically calculate their effect on something we can measure, like specific heat. And we'll see that there's experimental evidence for exactly these quantum species in conventional materials through this calculation. Okay, so you can't get anywhere in physics without grinding through all the details. And that's what we're going to start doing now. So the fun's over. Now we're going to talk about crystal lattices. One example of, a broken symmetry state. A crystal will be the ground state or vacuum state of a certain Hamiltonian. Which we won't talk about necessarily. I'm not going to find some Hamiltonian that came to me from, some theory. We're just going to talk about the various different symmetries that can be broken. Tomorrow, phonon excitations. Think of this as a microcosm for the vacuum. I'm going to give you a unique vacuum state. And the symmetries of that vacuum state dictate the interesting physics that can occur there. And like I say, if you're lucky and you study these things, you can get all sorts of excitations like monopoles or something like that, right? So to begin, we'll just define what is a crystal. A crystal is, one part of it is a lattice. Okay, I think you probably know what a lattice is, but let's define precisely. It's a set of points. And I'll pretty much stick to 1, 2, and 3 dimensions. We won't talk about higher dimensional objects, but they can be interesting. So, n's are integers. It can be 0, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2. And the A's are a set of linearly independent vectors. And K runs from 1 to D, as you can see, the dimension of the system. So that's one part of a crystal. One part of a crystal is a lattice. I should say crystal, one part is a lattice. OK, so that lattice has a type that has to do on the space group symmetry that we're not going to, I mean, there's lots of these symmetries. And the space group symmetry depends on the translation symmetry and also the crystal, the point group symmetries. But it depends on other things too. So let's say lattice translation. And so the lattice translation depends on, you know, the group under which the lattice is invariant, under which operations the lattice is invariant. As is a point group, which is like, you know, the rotations, reflections, and stuff like that. So I'd say a lattice is of the same type if under symmetry operations, particularly, you know, translation of these point groups, you know, two lattices are of the same type if they behave the same under these space group symmetries. Here's a one-dimensional lattice. You either imagine it going on forever, or it's periodic. And there's a symmetry associated with translation by A along the x direction. There is only one direction because it's one dimensional, right? So the set of lattice points is periodic. So that set of R, all the lattice points, is the same as if I translate by A. Any lattice of the same type gives me the same structure if I do this translation in one dimension. So how many one-dimensional lattices can there be? There's only one one-dimensional lattice. There's nothing, you know, above or below the plane. I can change the A, but the same symmetry operations, you know, that's the definition of the microscopic, so the lattice length scale, if you will. That's the length scale. That's like the UV cutoff that you're always worried about in field theories, right? In condensed matter, there's an explicit physical meaning to the UV cutoff, and that's the lattice length scale A. You can, but that's not called a lattice. That's a lattice and a basis, so we'll talk about that next. That's why I said this is only one part. That is the second part, is when you add a basis. But in terms of the formalism of how we deal with these problems in condensed matter, we separate those two. So what I mean by a lattice is that, you know, every point looks like every other point here. So we can keep playing this game in higher dimensions. So let me draw a two-dimensional lattice. So some periodic square lattice, they're called. So I have a set now of linearly independent vectors which define my lattice up there. So here I only had one, you know, it's like a vector, right, in the x direction. So here I can have a in the x direction, and the magnitude of that vector was just a. So here I have, you know, a1, say, but I also have to have an a2. And a1 can be times a. There's a 90 degree rotation symmetry here. There's some reflection symmetry if I reflect around an x axis, if I reflect around a y axis. So any lattice that behaves, is invariant under all the same symmetry groups as this thing, is called a square lattice. So how many lattices do you think there are in 2D? How many different lattice types? There's more than one. Wait, I think I wrote this down. There's five. So it's maybe not obvious, but I mean, at some point, somebody can you know, look at all the point group symmetries, look at all the way translations work, rotational symmetries, reflections, and so on. You can figure out how many lattices there are. Square is one. I can squish this square down so that, you know, A1 and A2, they're still linearly independent, but A, say, the magnitude of the A2 vector is smaller. That's called a rectangular lattice, right? So rectangular lattice, you've killed that 90 degree rotation symmetry. Triangle's another one. So triangle has a different rotation symmetry. So a triangular lattice, it's got like a 120 degree rotation symmetry. Uh-oh. All right. So I have lattice vectors A1. Say A2 here, the primitive vectors of the triangular lattice. I can call A1, A1, 0. Okay, so I've offset by 1, 0. A2 is something like, 1 half. You can say root 3 over 2, I think. Okay, so I've moved over by a half here, and then up root 3 by 2. Is that the only way I could have defined the primitive lattice vectors there? No. There's another way I could have defined, minus a half, say, moving up this way. Or I could have used any two of those. The condition on them being primitive lattice vectors is that they're linearly independent, right? So it doesn't matter how you construct that vector space, if you will. But in some sense, you have to keep track of the rotational invariance, so 60 degrees in this case, in order to define the symmetry. And so that rotational invariance defines triangular lattices. If you break that symmetry, just like I broke the square lattice symmetry, I forget that's called coupled rectangle, I think. That's what I wrote. No, it can't be right. Centered, it must be centered. Centered rectangle. Lose the 120 or whatever, the 60 degree rotation symmetry. Yeah, it's 120. Thank you. 120 degree rotation symmetry. That just means squishing that vector A2 down. And amazingly, there's only like one other lattice type, an oblique lattice, if you just define an arbitrary A1 and A2. So these are five lattice types. So those square and triangular and those rectangular and centered rectangle, it's called a center rectangle if you just squish it down and you can see you have a rectangle with like a site right in the center. Those are all some sort of higher symmetry case. They have these rotational symmetries which are broken down. And oblique's just the general case. Okay, now we'll do 3D. Question.
What about the hexagonal?
Hexagonal is triangular.
It is triangular.
Yeah. So it's triangular in America, and everywhere else it's hexagonal. Yeah, make a note of that. I'm not going to do three dimensions. I don't know if I wrote down how many there are. I did, there's 14, right? 3D, there's 14. So these are so-called Bervais lattices. Okay. Question?
Here we are only considering translational symmetry. We're not looking at lattices that can have rotational symmetry, but not.
Yeah, so
like,
so like a pneumatic, like a liquid crystal is one example where you have a broken rotational symmetry, but no broken translational symmetry necessarily. And quasicrystals also break. I mean, yeah, we won't deal with those. They're not a Bervais lattice. The problem is you can't use a Fourier analysis on those. That's why we don't look at them. So as you're going to discover quickly, you know, condensed matter theory is a theory in Fourier space.
So how do we define the rotational symmetry in the triangular lattice? Because it seems like if you're looking at rotations about one of the vertices, you do have 60 degrees of symmetry. Whereas if it's about the center of one of the triangles, it's 120.
Yeah, so there's some subtlety there, which is why I wrote 60. But I think it's actually 120 degree. So if you look at, so it's a good question. So I have to think about it more. Yeah, so I forget where that symmetry operation has to be around. So I'm not sure if it matters if you're in, I'll get myself in trouble if I try to answer it. I'm not sure if it might not matter if you're in, if you're tiling the plane in infinite space, but in other cases it might. So I just glossed over all this symmetry. I mean, it's the space group symmetry, which you can, I'm trying to give you an idea that there's translation and rotation involved, but there's other things that matter, especially in higher dimensions. But that's the flavor of it. So these are the Bervais lattices, they're called. And again, the choice of primitive vector is not unique, so let me just make a note. And again, as you saw when we looked at the triangular case, the primitive vectors define a unit cell. Okay, so for example, you can take the A1, A2 of a square lattice. And shade in that area defined by A1 and A2. And that's called the unit cell of the lattice. It has a certain volume. You could do with triangular or hexagonal. Something like this, right? And by construction, that unit cell has a volume. I'll call it VC. And it's, so it's like A1, A1, say dot A2. So A1 cross A2 dot A3, because there's a third dimension that we have to consider. So that's one way to think about it. A1, A2 dot A3. I can exchange any of those indices, depending on how I define my X, Y, and Z axes. So this is 3D. Okay, you're going to use this in your tutorial. That's the volume of a unit cell. And just like the unit vectors aren't unique, the choice of a unit cell is not unique. So a lot of this is just names now, but these are standard names. The Wigner-Seitz cell is just a convenient choice of this unit cell, where you can take each lattice point and find the part of space closer than it to any other point. So on a square lattice, my points are on the vertices here. I drew too small. Then my Wigner-Seitz cell is the region in space closest to that point. It has this volume, the same volume. And on a hexagonal lattice, that thing is a hexagon. You know, take a lattice point. There's a single lattice point on the triangular lattice. And bisect the lines. Perfect. That's the Wigner-Seitz unit cell. Okay, it's just a name for it. So I started off by saying all this sort of, I don't know, terminology is just one part of crystal systems. So crystalline systems, as we talked about, might have different primitive vectors, which we don't call them that, but they might have different vectors or translation vectors for every type of atom or for different types of atom. And so in order to formally discuss this, we introduce the concept of a basis. And crystals are made of lattices plus bases. And the basis is simply another set of vectors which offset your atom from the lattice point. That's all it is, okay? So that's the other part. That's the other part of your crystal. So every atom in a crystal has a lattice point, which is that thing up there. So and another vector, which for some reason I called S. And M can be one atom, or it can be up to whatever, say B. For B atoms in the basis. So what's an example of a lattice with a basis? The simplest one is the honeycomb, I think, or the nicest one is the honeycomb. So let me take my triangular or hexagonal lattice. Okay, and that's a bunch of lattice points defined by those primitive lattice vectors. Okay, so it's A1 and A2, 1, 0, and 1 half, root 3 over 2. And let me add basis vectors. I'm adding basis vectors to this triangular lattice, which are, there's two of them. So S1 is going to be 0, 0. So this spacing's A, say. So this would be A, 0, 0. I'll add an S2, which is something like offset here by 0, 1 over root 3. And that defines my atoms. Okay, so here's my lattice, and here's my two basis atoms. And I put them there for every single lattice point. And that defines a honeycomb structure. Well, it looked perfect in my head. But incidentally, I think this is why people say triangular lattice for the hexagonal lattice, because people mix up hexagonal and honeycomb. This is a bunch of like, you know, side-sharing hexagons, if you will. Okay, incidentally, this is the lattice structure of graphene. So graphene, which gets all this attention, like some relativistic Dirac point there, right? So there's some emergent physics that govern the excitations in a very fundamental way. That emergent physics comes from the underlying lattice structure under which the, you know, carbon atoms interact. So that structure is very important to the physics of graphene. Questions? So you can construct anything. We're not going to talk about three dimensions, but.
So what exactly do you mean by atom in this case?
Oh, I just meant degree of freedom, say. Okay. Degree of freedom of your Schrodinger, you know, whatever. So it could be spins, it could be electrons. I mean, you're constructing a lattice of somethings, right? It's not just empty spaces. So I just said atom because I don't want to say lattice point, because I want to use lattice for the Bervais lattices. But you
know, what is the lattice, just Rn by itself here, physically?
So the lattice, so I have primitive vectors of the lattice, A1 here and A2. Right, that's what I would call the triangular lattice. And then at each lattice point, so I translate here, here's the lattice point. I have two elements of the basis. Okay. And that defines what most people would call a lattice, but it's a non-Bervais lattice. And then you can put electrons on there, put carbon atoms, you can put spins, if you want to study some sort of honeycomb quantum computer, right? Whatever. Okay, so the only other thing I want to talk about today is your sort of first venture into Fourier space in this class, which is the reciprocal lattice. And if you're going to study condensed matter, you better be comfortable with studying things in Fourier space. So I'll start a new chalkboard. And you'll get some practice with this concept on your in your tutorial today. So reciprocal space is just a definition. Of another way of looking at periodic systems. And there's the existence of the reciprocal lattice comes out of, you know, the invariance of a crystal or crystalline structure or a real space lattice under translation. So this lattice is defined as being invariant under some translation operator. In three dimensions, I have my primitive lattice vectors in some u1, u2, u3, say. Just some integers, user integers. And when I said atoms there, I can imagine those atoms have a wave function. They could have electronic density. They could have a spin state, right? There's something interesting about those atoms that I want to study on this lattice. Whatever that function is, it obeys, you know, so I'm going to call that whatever, N or F I could call it, just some function, say it's electron density or, you know, but F at some R in the crystal is equal to F of R with that translation vector added to it. Which means if I'm sitting on the lower left here and I translate across to the upper right, okay, the say the electronic structure, if I'm at that lower point or that upper point, the electronic density, the wave function essentially has to obey this form. So, well, I guess next class we'll talk about Bloch's theorem, which is a little more precise statement of this fact. But now let me just ensure this. By taking the Fourier transform, so this is ensured if my function at R is some discrete, say Fourier transform, function at G, and I'm defining some vector G here, G dot R. Okay, so I've just applied Fourier's theorem to this. This is a Fourier transformation. So whatever that function is, there's some inverse function, okay, and I have e to the I g dot r, and that g is a reciprocal lattice vector. I'll define what that is here. And that reciprocal lattice vector makes it such that, let me translate this function by t. So f of g, e to the I, g dot r, plus t. So I can split these up, e to the I, g dot t. And that e to the I, g dot t has to be equal 1 for this to be satisfied. Right? So that defines my reciprocal lattice vector G. So the reciprocal lattice vector is something that lives in 4A space fundamentally. I can determine what it is. And by the way, that f of g, that's just the, you know, the 4A coefficient. You can just take the inverse transformation to find out what that is, but I'm not going to talk about it. We'll worry about that later. So what is the reciprocal lattice? Right, to find g, just write it out as in the same form as my lattice vectors. So it's an integer and a primitive vector, which lives in reciprocal space. So the b's are like the primitive lattice vectors in reciprocal space. And to satisfy this condition that e to the I g dot t is equal to 1, then you know the b's have to be equal to something such that bi dot ai is, you know, 2 pi times a delta function ij. So that's 0 if they're not equal and 1 if they're equal, if the indices are equal. Pardon? Oh, yeah. I need a j here, yeah. So if they're ii, they're always equal. Okay, so that's it. So the reciprocal lattice is just this object that has these, that satisfies these conditions. So g dot t, right? So it's 2 pi, say, you know, these are unit vectors, so it's just v1, u1. Or my translations, yeah, u. So v1, u1. V2, U2. And you can solve that to give a form for all the BIs. So, and all it is 2 pi over the volume of the unit cell that I defined right there, times, that's I, so it's J. So it's aj cross ak. And that gives me b1 a2 cross a3. Oh, I forgot my 2 pi already. It's 2 pi. And then it's a1. This is the volume of the unit cell. Which is always the same. I don't know why I wrote those all out. So,
I have a question. So this implies that whenever a Fourier transform the lattice, it doesn't preserve the form of the lattice, right? I mean, in Fourier space,
right.
It has a different form. So what about if I have a lattice with a basis?
Mm-hmm.
I've Fourier transform the lattice, but what about the basis?
Yeah, you also do the basis elements. So the translation vector has to be the translation vector of the, you know, even if it's a non-Bravais lattice, the lattice under consideration. So if it's a honeycomb, that translation has to incorporate that basis into it. So you know, it can be quite complicated to do the Fourier transform if it's a lattice with a basis. So the lattice is the reciprocal lattice is different than the real space lattice. So what's the reciprocal of the reciprocal lattice?
It's the
lattice. So if you're wondering if you did it right, you can always Fourier transform back. You know. So in your tutorial, you're going to look at these relationships here and calculate the volume of the unit cell in reciprocal space. And then you'll do some questions also in real space. Okay, so after you get some practice with that, we'll talk a little bit more about periodic functions, lattices and reciprocal lattices at the start of next class. And then we'll move on to the excitations in these lattices, which are the really interesting thing, which are these phonons. Questions?
So up to just redefining a basis in terms of linear combinations itself, is there always a unique choice of the lattice basis pair?
I mean, there's no. I mean, you could choose other vectors for those, what did I call them, S vectors or whatever, up there. So I have two, S1 and S2. That's not unique.
But I guess what I mean is, could we have chosen a basis to put onto this lattice such that we actually gained an extra symmetry, and then we could just incorporate that symmetry into a new lattice?
So it's like take a square lattice. Can you take a square lattice, add a basis vector to get a triangular lattice, say, which is a different symmetry?
Well, it probably wouldn't be triangular, but sure. Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be any of the other Bravais lattices.
Okay.
Unless you have some special case, like, you know, your A1 is, you know, your y direction is twice as big, and then you add another like basis vector to make it square. So it only, you know, so in that case, you can take a rectangular lattice and make a square lattice. Okay. But
it would only ever be something.
It's just gonna be another Bravais lattice and it has to be a special choice. It's like a fine tuning problem. Yeah, okay. You have to fine tune the basis choice to get back that Bravais lattice. Other questions? Okay, if not, I'll see you guys tomorrow.